community was held in exciting Las Vegas, Nevada from July 9th through the 11th, 1999. This is videotape number 4.
Right now, I'd like to bring, without any further BS, up the stage, someone that everyone's been waiting for. If you would come on down, both of you. Does anyone know who this is, or do you want me to actually introduce them? Thank you very much. And I'm going to turn it over to them, and you all have a good day.
Good afternoon, everybody. Can you guys hear me in the back?
Yeah.
Great. I'm Jennifer Granick. I'm a lawyer. I represent people charged with crimes, and I work in San Francisco. This is Kevin Paulson. I'm going to go first. I want to make sure I get my time. This is... This is a great country because we have certain rights that are assured to us in the Constitution. One of the problems is that we don't necessarily always know those rights. And Kevin and I are here to talk to you today about two in particular. The right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure, which is the Fourth Amendment, and the right not to be forced to incriminate yourself, which is the Fifth Amendment. I'm going to do a legal spiel really quick, and in about 10 or 15 minutes, you're going to learn what it took me a whole semester to learn about the Constitution in law school. I'm not going to take questions right now because I want to go through it really quickly. So if you have questions about either the Fourth or the Fifth Amendments, try to remember them and save them to the end. Okay, the Fourth Amendment, a personal favorite. The Fourth Amendment says you have the right to be free from an unreasonable search or seizure. The first question you ask yourself when you're wondering if the Fourth Amendment applies to determine whether something's a search is you have to ask whether you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that thing, that place, that item, or in your person. Reasonable expectation of privacy. It's a little legal jargon. What do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in? Your house, used to be your car, your person, your papers, all those things, your belongings. If you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in something, and the law, and somebody from the government wants to search it, what do they need? That's one thing that you definitely want to remember when you're talking about the Fourth Amendment. It applies to state action. That is a government actor. It does not apply to your boss. None of these rules will apply to any private parties. Okay? So you don't have Fourth Amendment protection from the actions of private parties. First question is there a warrant based on probable cause? We know what a warrant is. It's issued by a judge. And it has to be issued based on an affidavit. The affidavit has to provide probable cause. What is probable cause? Probable cause is enough evidence or information to show that it's more likely than not that the person or the place that's to be searched or seized is involved in criminal activity, has been or currently is involved in criminal activity. Now, if there is a warrant based on probable cause, then the police have the right to search, and the search will be legal, and any evidence which is found pursuant to that search is admissible against, I'll use the word you, in court. What if there's not a warrant? The vast majority of searches that occur these days occur without a warrant. If there's no warrant, then the search is presumptively illegal, and the person, in this case, the prosecution, who wants to put the evidence into court, has to show that there is an exception to the requirement for the warrant. There's many, many exceptions. I'm going to talk about two primarily, because these are the most important ones. Okay. Vehicle search. The way that the law is today, when you are in a car, you do not have reasonable expectation of privacy anymore. The police can stop and search through your car for almost any reason. Even the most minor traffic infraction can give them cause to stop your car and search it, even if they have some other reason why they stopped you, even if they stopped you because they didn't like the way you looked. If you have a taillight out or have a trailer hitch blocking your license plate or anything, a dangly thing which is blocking your rearview mirror, all of these things are reasons why, at least in the state of California, the police can then pull you over and subsequently look through your car. Think of your car as a Fourth Amendment free zone. You get in there, you're basically saying, search me. Remember that. And the second exception, and perhaps the most important, is consent. If the police knock on your door and they ask to come in, they don't need probable cause and they don't need a warrant if you say yes. Okay? Consent is the number one way that law enforcement gets to get into people's cars, into people's houses, into people's purses, into people's briefcases, into their back pockets of their clothes or jackets or backpacks. It's consent. You never need to consent to a search. Okay? If you don't consent, and there's no warrant, and there's no probable cause, and there's no other exception, any search that happens subsequently is not going to produce evidence that can be used against you in court. I put the third exception, exigent circumstances, on there just because it's really one of the most broad. If there's no warrant, the police can still search if there's exigent circumstances, something that makes it impossible for them to go and get a warrant. For example, hot pursuit is an exigent, is a type of exigent circumstance. You've all seen those shows on Fox where cops are chasing people in their cars, they're driving drunk and weaving, and it just seems like invariably they go to their own houses and pull into their own driveways, jump out of their car and run for their house, thinking somehow once they get there, they're going to be safe. Well, that's hot pursuit, and the police would be allowed to follow that person into their house. It's an example of exigent circumstance. Another exigent circumstance, which I see very commonly, is that evidence will be destroyed. They knock on the door, they say, open up, it's the police, and inside they hear people scrambling and the sound of toilets flushing. And they're thinking, something's going on in there, we've got to bust in and see what it is. That's another example of a possible exigent circumstance that would potentially excuse a warrantless search or entry into a house. Okay? That's the Fourth Amendment. That's what's left of the Fourth Amendment. I know. Okay. This is the Fifth Amendment. People are a little less familiar with the Fifth Amendment because I think it comes from actually two separate principles. The first idea behind the Fifth Amendment is that a confession which is beaten out of somebody is not reliable. Okay, that's thing number one. The law took a long, long time to realize this. But now we have that. And the second principle, which is behind the Fifth Amendment, is sort of a more esoteric one. And that is that the integrity of the person, of the self, or of your mind should be respected to the extent that the government should not be able to force you to turn against yourself. That there's something immoral and wrong with forcing a person to turn against themselves and to act in their own worst interest and to help put themselves in jail or prison. So those are sort of the two principles behind the Fifth Amendment. The first question you ask when you want to know whether the Fifth Amendment applies to some sort of statement, we're talking about confessions here basically, is the confession voluntary? Now, voluntariness is sort of a slippery concept, but basically if it's beaten out of you, or if you're somehow if it's beaten out of you, or if they say, you know, we're going to beat up your, we have your wife and child in the back trunk of our car, and if you don't tell us, we're going to you won't see them again. Something like that would certainly make a statement involuntary. From there, it's kind of a mishmash in terms of what the law says. If I lie, if I'm the law enforcement person and I have somebody and I tell them lies, like, we've got an open and shut case against you, why don't you just make it easier for yourself by telling us what you really did? Anybody ever heard that before? That's not necessarily going to make it involuntary. If they say something to you like, listen, you know, we're going to tell your mom if you don't just tell us what happened, that doesn't necessarily make it involuntary. All of these things would depend. So voluntariness is a slippery concept, but basically, that's the primary question you ask in a Fifth Amendment analysis. If a statement or a confession is given and it is not voluntary, then it is excluded from evidence for all purposes. Okay? Let me explain what I mean when I say excluded from evidence. First, that means that it was obtained unconstitutionally. And secondly, what that means is that the exclusionary rule applies. Real quick, what the exclusionary rule is the way that the court punishes law enforcement for having done it wrong. You did it wrong, now you don't get to use it. That's the exclusionary rule in a nutshell. Okay, what if the statement is voluntary? It wasn't beaten out of the person. The person did give the confession voluntarily. There's another question in the Fifth Amendment, and that's Miranda. Now, I'm sure almost everybody here has heard of Miranda. Is that right?
Firsthand.
Or heard the Miranda warnings firsthand. Many people think that whenever you're arrested, the police officer has to give you your Miranda rights. You have the right to remain silent, blah, blah, blah. That is not true. Miranda needs to be read to a suspect only in one circumstance, when the suspect is under custodial interrogation. Okay, so two-part question. Custodial. That means that you are arrested or in jail or at the police station. Does it mean I'm handcuffed by the side of the road next to my car? Maybe. Sometimes it does. Does it mean I'm at the jail but I'm not handcuffed and they ask me to come there? Maybe. Sometimes. It all depends. Okay, it's not necessarily a clear-cut, bright-line thing. But if you are arrested, that is custodial. Before arrest, no Miranda. And it has to be interrogation. They have to be asking you questions or saying something to you which is designed to elicit information about the crime that they're investigating. Okay? Custodial interrogation. If you are in custody and you are being interrogated, then police need to read you your Miranda warnings first. Once they read the warning, you can waive your rights under Miranda by continuing to talk. Or you can invoke your Miranda rights. There's two main rights you have under Miranda, and they're related, but they're actually different. The email address is Kevin's email address. The other one was mine. You have the right to remain silent, okay? And if you police read you the Miranda warnings and you say, I don't want to talk, you've invoked your right to remain silent. You also have the right to have counsel present with you at the interrogation, and an attorney can be appointed for you if you cannot afford one. The right to counsel is far more powerful. Requesting your right to counsel is far more powerful than simply requesting your right to remain silent for a variety of reasons which I don't necessarily need to get into here. It also, many people find it difficult to say no to law enforcement. That's for two reasons. One, people sometimes have a feeling that they want to please someone in authority. Now, I know no one in this room necessarily has that problem. But the second reason is that these people are trained to get information out of suspects. That is what they're trained for. That's their job. That's what they do. And believe me, they're very good at it. So, it is often easier for people, rather than to say, no, I'm not going to talk to you, to say, I want my attorney to be here. Okay? And even if you don't have an attorney, just say that. You want an attorney. It's a much more assured way to make sure that you are protecting your rights under the Fifth Amendment. Okay, so that's the law of the Fourth and Fifth Amendment in a nutshell. It took me a whole semester in law school, basically, to go through that, but now you have it. What we're going to do now is have sort of a case study in an investigation in which the Fourth and Fifth Amendment applies.
Sort of a... This is sort of an educational video on how to throw away your Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights. Once the projector is warmed up. Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. For those who don't know, my name is Kevin Poulsen. I'm currently a journalist. It was an easy decision to make. It was sort of like, as a convicted felon, how do I go down any further in the social order of things? And I decided to become a journalist. And I've had a lot of interactions where with the federal government over the years. This just didn't do anything.
Inside the labyrinth of the telephone company's huge computer system, one feels a sense of insignificance. It seems impossible that any single person could jam up these sophisticated works. Yet think of it. All the interactive computers across the country are linked by telephone lines. Both private citizens and classified government operations can be vulnerable to a computer genius one another.
His mother died when he was still young. One of Kevin's friends describes him as very bright, with great potential, but always painfully shy. Kevin Poulsen received his first computer on his 16th birthday. Like most devoted hackers, he adopted a colorful pseudonym. Kevin Poulsen became Dark Dante. Eventually, he discovered a telephone number for ARPANET, a computer network funded by the Pentagon. It links university and think-tank computers across the country by telephone lines. For Dark Dante, ARPANET was a tantalizing challenge. After connecting his modem with the ARPANET telephone number, Kevin realized he was hooked up to military research at the University of California, Berkeley. Dark Dante's activities were soon detected by UCB. When Kevin slipped, and on one occasion only, used his real name instead of Dark Dante, he was trapped. Blissfully unaware, Kevin continued his hacking activities, giving authorities even more ammunition against him.
Dan, just put that in my car, please.
You taking my computer?
Yes.
On the morning of September 22nd, 1983, the Los Angeles DA confiscated Kevin's computer.
Look, Kevin, you and your buddy have committed a crime here. Now, you're only 17, and we're going to try to keep you out of this, but your buddy's going to jail.
Because of his age, he was not officially charged, only warned that his computer activities were illegal.
Your buddy is going to jail.
The warning apparently fell on deaf ears. During the next year, Kevin took a high school equivalency exam and moved out of his parents' house to Northern California. But Doc Dante had not died with Kevin's move. He had simply changed locations. In his off hours, Kevin Poulsen continued to cruise the electronic highways cloaked with a pseudonym. This time, he never gave his real name or his location. On February 9, 1988, the owners of a storage facility in Northern California made a routine stop at a locker in which the rent had not been paid.
There we go.
Standard procedure in such cases is to confiscate the material in the locker.
Whoa!
But the contents of this locker is something the men had never seen before. It appeared to be stolen telephone company equipment. The owners notified the authorities.
We're on a storage locker that contained pieces of electronic equipment, payphones, computer printouts, including the printout of the non-published number of the Soviet embassy in San Francisco. It was quite obviously stolen property.
Whose locker is this? Some guy by the name of John Anderson.
Anderson, he...
The name John Anderson was a fake.
Several months ago.
Several items in the locker bore the name Kevin Polson. It appeared as if Doc Dante had been caught again. Authorities apprehended Kevin, who agreed to a consent search of his apartment. They were astonished to find that Kevin had a complete wiretapping facility in a spare bedroom.
What are you doing all this stuff, Kevin?
Connected to Kevin's computer was an unauthorized tether set which could be used to tap into private phone lines.
I got that from a buddy of mine.
Only the telephone company and through them legally authorized law enforcement officers are allowed to use test sets. Incredibly, the authorities found photographs Kevin Polson had taken of himself breaking into a telephone switching trailer, then using the equipment inside. Kevin's ego provided the phone company with the evidence they needed to bring in the FBI. Investigators found that over the last year, someone matching Kevin Polson's description had illegally entered several Northern California telephone facilities using a false ID.
Hi, can I help you? Yeah. In the park office. I'm here to check out the ESS. The ESS equipment is up on the second floor.
Once inside the building, the intruder found telephone numbers he could use to get inside the phone company's computer system. He also stole manuals, switching equipment, and a test set like the one found in Kevin Polson's apartment. Kevin Polson had allegedly infiltrated U.S. military computer transmissions, obtaining classified Army information. Authorities believe he also obtained classified information about the FBI investigation of overthrown Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos. In addition, he may have wiretapped and tape-recorded the phone conversations of his friend, Sean Randall. The test set found in Kevin's apartment and his possession of the unlisted Soviet number led the FBI to believe that Kevin Polson might be engaging in espionage. On October 19, 1989, a two-year investigation resulted in a 19-count indictment against Kevin Polson and two fellow hackers. They were charged with conspiracy, computer fraud, wiretapping, embezzlement, and theft of public property and records. The two other men were arrested and now await trial. But Kevin Polson has fled.
One can only speculate about what motivated Kevin Polson. Those of you in the play fair agree that he's an unusually talented and bright young man, possibly a genius. But now he is a wanted man, facing up to 37 years in prison.
Update. Shortly after our broadcast, the FBI received information that Kevin Polson was living near Los Angeles, California.
Our San Francisco office advised us that Polson had some acquaintances in the Los Angeles area. We went out and interviewed those acquaintances, and one of them advised us that he had been seen in the not-too-distant past at Hughes Market. We then went out and interviewed all the employees at Hughes Market and displayed his photograph.
3 weeks later, Polson returned to the supermarket.
I walked past Kevin, and it dawned on me that that's the person in the photo.
Ryan immediately notified the FBI. However, Polson was able to leave the store before agents could respond.
The FBI informed me that Kevin Polson had been seen at the Van Nuys Shoes Market at about 10 or 10:30 in the evening. I decided to surveil the market, thinking Kevin may show up again. At about 10 minutes to midnight, Kevin Polson arrived. I drove up and parked immediately in front of the market.
Believing that Polson would again elude capture, two store clerks made a daring move.
Security!
A security guard escorted Polson to a storeroom where he was held until FBI agents arrived and placed him under arrest.
Here.
During the search, search of Mr. Polson, we found some handcuff keys in his eyeglass cases. During the time that he was in custody, he claimed that his contact lenses were drying out and he had asked for his eyeglass cases to be sent to him. So I'm assuming that he was looking for the handcuff keys.
Kevin Polson is currently being held at Santa Clara County Jail in Northern California, awaiting trial. If convicted of all the charges against him, Polson could receive a maximum sentence of 37 years behind bars.
So the first lesson here is always smile for your mugshot, because you really never know where it's going to turn out. Mike, testing. Can you hear me back? Hello? All right. Since I'm here, obviously I didn't get 37 years behind bars. The government actually wound up charging me with espionage, not with passing classified information to... Not nice. Is this any better?
No!
He's working it. He's working it. Alright, our tech guy's walking into the crowd, which means this is as loud as it's going to get. So they wound up charging me with unauthorized possession of classified documents under the espionage statutes. It was a year in prison before I even knew... Before I even knew what the classified documents were, it turned out that they'd gone through my home directory while I was working for a defense contractor and found an air tasking order from an Air Force exercise that I had been given in an unclassified environment in order to write some software to help process it. The ATO was, as we call it, was in fact unclassified, or so I was told by SRI, and everybody at SRI believed. The FBI wound up classifying it for the purpose of my case. It took about 5 years for us to gather all the evidence that we needed in order to prove that I was innocent, and the government wound up dropping the charge a few days before trial. So I pled guilty to cheating at radio station phone-in contests while I was a few... I was not with Mennick, no. We never hooked up. That would have been cool, though. We made a good team. Anyway, cheating radio station phone-in contests, gaining information pertaining to how the FBI does wiretaps, and lying about my social security number to the phone company. So I've made some mistakes in my life, in addition to committing a number of felonies. What you saw up there was me throwing away my rights to make them get a search warrant before searching my apartment. What they don't show is that they had told me that if I didn't consent to a search, that they would surround my apartment with cops until they were able to get a search warrant. And at that time, it was still early enough in the investigation that I had some hopes of, you know, not becoming hated and feared by my neighbors and maybe keeping my job. So and that compelled me to allow them to search, which was one less thing that I could challenge in court. I basically gave up my ability to challenge the constitutionality of their search. You saw me talking. It wasn't... can you hear me? Somebody gesticulating wildly. you saw me talking. A lot of what I was telling them wasn't true, but anything that I told them that was true and that helped me wouldn't want to be inadmissible in court anyway. The lesson there is that there's really, you can never really gain anything. The man's a professional. Let him do his job.
Did they hear me? It's electronics.
Okay. Can I be heard now?
Hold on a second. I'm going to start calling you guys names because you're obviously a member of the department. Hey, why are you
messing with the fire alarm phone here? Hey, come on. You know, ah, go up. Put the big white pants on. Dude, why are you messing with me, Ryan? You know, come on. Let's be adult. Maybe when you hear this, if you're a little sociopathic for females, if you're a
smoking thing in jail, cigarettes. 50 cents a pack in federal prison. There's no cigarette tax. I haven't been able to quit since. No, Marlboro Light. So, what I've learned is that if you talk to the FBI, even in your own defense, even if it's something that you're not guilty of and you're defending yourself, they don't tape record your interview. What they do is they write up something called a 302, which is the FBI agent's interpretation of what you said. I think that they have some special school in Quantico where they teach them creative writing for the purpose of a 302. So anything you say that helps you will either be omitted from the 302, or it will be changed in such a way that it helps you less or even hurts you. Anything that you say that hurts you will hurt you even more by the time it winds up in that FBI report. The best thing to do, especially if you're innocent, is to request that you speak to your attorney, like Jennifer Brown, and just say nothing more at that point. At that point, they're legally required to stop questioning you. They probably won't. Later on, they'll say you never asked for your attorney. It's better to just clam up. Even if you want to become a snitch, which I don't recommend, you'll find that you'll get a better deal if you wait and find an attorney who's willing to represent you and help you betray everybody that you know. Then if you just try to cut a deal for yourself from the word go. So lawyers serve a valuable purpose, whether you're guilty or innocent. The FBI, the I is supposed to stand for investigation. The fact is, they're really part of the adversarial process. Their goal is to lock you up. They're not independent fact finders. They're not scientists. And they'll do whatever they can to accomplish their goal, knowing that your side, you and your attorneys, will do everything that they can and you can to keep from going to jail. So the system only works if you respect the adversarial process and don't help out the bad guys. And between the video and what I've just said, I think I've covered a decent amount of time. So I'm just going to open it up to questions for either Jennifer or myself.
What do you do when a bad boy happens to you?
One more time? I'll have you know he's a manager now. It's it was two bad boys, in my defense. And you know, I'm a lover, not a fighter.
In the back. The question is whether you have a legal right to see the warrant or affidavit before they search. You have a legal right to see the warrant, but not to see the affidavit. Like where the hat.
Fifth Amendment question. If I've got encrypted files and I'm the only one who knows the password, and I think Kevin dealt with this, can they force you to decrypt the files, or is that considered self-incrimination?
The question is, if you have encryption, can they force you to decrypt or give over the password? And in my opinion, that's a Fifth Amendment problem. There's some ways that I think that they could probably get around that, but basically, you wait for a court order to tell you to do something like that before you go right ahead.
I'll add to that and say that there's a bill in Congress now to change that would legally compel you to give up your encryption key.
Also, then, President, Bill Clinton's counsel is looking into the back doors and all the encryptions, so the government.
Right, the key escrow thing is continuing, but I think anybody who already has PGP will probably be safe from that.
Play in the back? Does the search warrant have a time limit? Yes, it does. It has to be timely, so that from the time it's issued to the time that the search is executed can't be an unreasonable delay. Also, there has to not be an unreasonable delay between the activity which forms the basis for probable cause and the seeking of the warrant and the actual search. I'm sorry?
Does it have to be during the day?
It doesn't have to be during the day. You can ask for special permission to have it be at night. Okay? And you can also ask for special permission so that you don't have to knock and announce. Okay? Ray in the back?
Can they search for anything, or does that have to be a new search warrant?
Can they search for anything? The things that they can search for must be specifically named in the warrant. The places to be searched and the things to be seized must be specifically named. However, what if they see something incriminating lying out there? Once they're in your house, they can pretty much grab anything that looks incriminating. Also, if you're looking at a search that's not pursuant to warrant, pretty much whatever they see, it's called what's in plain view. They can pretty much grab any of that. The fact is, once the police are in your house, it's almost like free reign. But yes, the warrant does have to name specifically. The question is whether, for the vehicle exception, whether that applies to bikes as well as to motorhomes. And the answer basically, it's a complicated question, but the answer basically is yes. Anything you can run away from the police on, it's an exigency and probably the warrant requirement does not apply. Right here in front.
You never hear about bounty hunters having hunting hackers. Don't they have different rights of bounty hunters about cops when it comes to search and seizure?
He's asking me a question about bounty hunters who are looking for people who've jumped bail or hunting for someone like that. The reason why they can have bounty hunters looking for people who've jumped bail is because when you sign for a bail bond, first of all, it's kind of a private party, but also when you sign for a bail bond, so you sign that you know that people might be coming looking for you if you jump bail and all of that. So it's different than for law enforcement. You with the green shirt.
When we're searching your vehicle, does that include all locks in here or serial on that vehicle? Is that concerned as well? Or is there a limit to how people can go into your suitcase or whatever?
The question is whether in the search for the vehicle they can search locked containers within the vehicle or open the trunk or look at locked containers in the trunk. And the law on all these things is very complicated as it's developed, but basically anything within the driver's area, the compartment, the driving compartment of the car, absolutely. And I think that the law now is also yes for the trunk and maybe also even yes for locked containers in the trunk. So that's why I say that you want to be careful with a car, because a car is basically, it's a free-for-all. All right, we'll look over here now. In the white shirt in the back?
Let's say a couple of FBI agents wanted to come over to just talk to you and you invite them into your home. Would they be able to search the vehicle without charges if you just turn the police over?
Do you want to tell them? The question is, let's say you invite the FBI over for a cup of coffee.
Right.
Then what? Can they just go nuts or what? That's the question.
So yeah, they can't tear your apartment apart, but I believe anything in plain sight, they can use to get a search warrant and to come back in force.
No, they can't take it. Once they're inside, it sort of has to do with the scope of your consent. So you invite them in. That means they can go in your bathroom, maybe even open up your medicine cabinet, but you might not let them in your bedroom or to, turn on your system. So there they would not be able to do that. In the red shirt? What's reasonable? And the answer is, it's a question of the totality of the circumstances. Okay? This is one of those fuzzy legal concepts. This is why you need to hire a lawyer. We make these things particularly obtuse so that we're still needed. If there was a clear answer, no one would want us around. blue in the orange shirt. Okay.
Once you get arrested and you had to write sentences,
even though you've been given your Miranda rights and you want to invoke them, what information are you required to give? Name, rank, serial number. Okay? That other orange shirt person. Okay, he's asking me about a recent Supreme Court case involving a traffic infraction for which the person was pulled over, and then the question was, could they search the car pursuant to that? That has to do, that case actually has to do a little bit with the specificity of that law and whether or not the person was allowed to be arrested for that infraction or only cited and released, okay? So basically, my understanding of that case, and it only came out a couple months ago, is that if it is a traffic infraction for which the police could arrest you, even if usually they don't arrest you, then they can search you in the car, because it would ordinarily be a search incident to arrest. However, if state law is such that for that infraction they are only allowed to cite and release you, no search. That's what I think the case stands for. Okay. Way at the back, and then you. Do you think I'm going to answer that in this crowd? The other person who I said. What are you going to do when the feds seize your stuff but they didn't have probable cause and you're innocent? What happens then? Well, if you can find a lawyer, you can sue them, right? But they have immunity, and what's the damages? No lawyer wants... Well, hello? I found my time's up. Not much. Not much. An innocent person who has an illegal search against them has very little legal recourse, unfortunately. That's why it's important to know your rights. You can sue, but good luck. We're offline. Sorry.